Good evening, everyone. I would like to call the study session of the University City City Council meeting to order on April the 12th at 5:30 p.m. Before we turn the program over to our guests, Mr. Rose, our members of council, do you have changes to this evening's regular agenda?
Honorable Mayor, I have one change, if it's appropriate to.
Please.
I am recommending that the council continue item H3 to April the 26th.
Okay. Hearing no other changes from members of the council, Mr. Rose, would you like to move forward with the agenda?
Honorable Mayor and council members, tonight you will hear from your advisory committee on stormwater management. I believe I have the public works director that is here that will introduce this item. Mr. Appleson.
Thank you, Mr. Rose. Mayor Crow, members of City Council, this evening we have Mr. Stein, commissioner with the Commission on Stormwater Issues, as well as Mr. Thompson, chairman of the commission, with us. The topic that Mr. Stein will be the lead presenter on is the flood early warning system. Mr. Stein.
Thank you, Sinan. The presentation I'm about to give has been updated slightly over the one you have. So with your permission, I'm going to share my screen here. All right, hopefully everyone is seeing that.
Not yet.
Oops. Okay, I have it up here on share screen. Do I need permission from somebody there to do this perhaps?
No, I think it should come up. But I have it here. Would you like me to see if I can pull it up and you can just tell me when to change slides?
Yeah, that's probably the presentation, the earlier presentation, but that's close enough if we can't make this work.
I believe this is your right one. Just a second.
Except now I'm going to have to get out of screen share here. Hang on. Okay.
Ready?
Yeah, go ahead.
There we go.
Oh, excellent. Is there a way to switch that to presentation?
Yeah. Did it switch?
Okay, thank you very much. All right, there we go. All right. That scene, by the way, is probably taken at the peak of the 2008 flood. That's about 200 yards upstream of the site of the fatalities on Wilson Avenue, except this is on the eastern side of the stream. Let's see, can I control slides here? Okay, next slide, please. Thanks. A little background. Both the Army Corps and the Stormwater Task Force have recommended a warning system. When we started looking into this in 2018, we were happy to discover that the city already has a couple of important resources in place for a system. Before you can even start thinking about buying equipment, you've got to have some basis for being able to predict flooding. And that requires having extensive historical data on stream levels and rainfalls that have occurred in the watershed. And we did find that that is in existence and it was accessible to us. And we had the expertise on the task force for analyzing that data. Those two things are the most difficult and expensive components of any flood warning system. If you don't have that data, and you have to pay for the new instrumentation to be installed to gather that data, plus take at least months to collect data and then pay someone to analyze it, you've got pretty big bucks involved. We already have this in place. So then we started looking at equipment and were surprised to find that it was a lot more affordable than we expected. So based on that, we recommended in our report to the city we gave you, I guess, last January or February, that we go ahead and develop our own system and stay, instead of waiting for the Army Corps, given how long that might take and given the uncertainty of their funding for projects like that. Okay, Larice, if you would, please. Thanks. Let's look first at just the generic components of a flood warning system. Number one, I just kind of covered, you've got to have some protocol established for predicting flooding. You need rain gauges, and those have to be located in the watershed. We discovered pretty early that if we tried to correlate rainfall at Weldon Springs or Lambert Field from the Weather Service with flooding here, there was not always a correlation. And that's because the rainfall in this area is sometimes very localized. We have a stream gauge in place. That was essential for the historical data, but in our case, the River De Pere floods too quickly for it to be an actual input to a warning system. By the time it indicates a problem, it's too late. And I guess in addition to the gauges, you need some way of recording the data that those gauges acquire, and some kind of a way to transmit that data to a control center, and then a control center where all of that data is collected, recorded, analyzed, and where alarms are configured and from which they are issued. And finally, you have to have a system for disseminating warnings to the public, along with the established emergency protocols. Next slide, please. If I could have the next slide. Would you back
that's
up?
All right.
All right, thanks. So let's take those things kind of in order. Prediction protocol. I mentioned data. We knew going in that we had the stream gauge, the USGS stream gauge over in Heeman Park at Purdue Avenue. That's been running for a little over 20 years. That gauge records stream stage, that is water level, and flow rates every 5 minutes, 24/7, and it's done it for 20 years, and the data is accessible online. What we didn't know is that we had rain gauges. We searched for rain gauges in our watershed, and we discovered that MSD actually has a network of about 100 gauges operating in the St. Louis area that they're using for Project CLEAR. And six of them are in or near our watershed. So we contacted MSD and they were very accommodating. They gave us login privileges to their data collection site so that we were able to access the historical rain gauge readings. So with, and again, six gauges, readings every 5 minutes for 10 years. So we have about 7 million data points there. over the winter of 18 and 19, Commission Member Bob Criss, Professor Criss, if you don't know him, he's Professor of Earth Science and Planetary Science at OSU and a recognized river expert on both large and small streams, downloaded that and built a database from it, which I might add was time consuming because a lot of that had to be done by hand because of missing data and timestamps that had to be converted and things that didn't align. But once he had that database established, was able to experiment with various rainfall scenarios to see how well they correlated to the floods that we know occurred from the gauge in Heeman Park, and found a statistically reliable basis for flood prediction. So with that in hand, we went looking at equipment. And if I could have the next slide, please. So the National Weather Service recommends that for a watershed the size of ours, you need 3 rain gauges to adequately sample the rainfall. And so we have 3 professional automated rain gauges in the watershed. Well, one is at the Wilson Buyout Tract right at Wilson and Drexel. That is up and operational. Second one is at Fogarty Park. That one's up and operational. And a third one is pending in Indian Meadows Park in Olivet, we hope. I'll come back to that in a minute. These gauges have integrated data loggers. We have it configured to record rainfall in 5-minute intervals, but the gauges don't transmit unless there's rainfall. They turn on automatically at rainfall and start transmitting those readings every 5 minutes to the control center. Thank you. If you're wondering what one of these things looks like, over here on the left, that's just a cover for the collection apparatus. There's a funnel there on the top where the rainfall is collected. The rainfall, as it drips through the funnel, drips into here over on the right-hand side, what's called a tipping bucket. It's a teeter-totter arrangement with a little water container, a little bucket on either side. And as it drips into the bucket here, it tips it. And then the other bucket is positioned under the drip. So this thing teeter-totters back and forth. It only takes 1/100 of an inch of rainfall to tip the bucket, by the way. So this is a professional grade instrument. When it tips, it triggers a little micro switch back behind that you can't see that sends a pulse to the processor. And then that takes that information and converts it into various rainfall parameters that it reports. Down here is the integrated data logger and the modem that transmits the data. You can see the antenna sticking down here. And these things are freestanding. We don't have any data wiring that has to be attached since it's all wireless. And the power is by battery. There's a big battery pack right there. And that battery is kept charged by the solar panels. This is Josh from Public Works installing the gauge at Fogarty Park about a month ago. The two gauges that are up are mounted on surplus street light poles that Sinan procured for us. So here's a good visual of how they're distributed across the watershed. Now this, don't confuse the Upper River De Pere watershed with the U City watershed. This is the portion of the watershed that drains directly into the channel from the headwaters in Olivet and overland down to the tunnel. You see, just to locate you, here's the tunnel right here. Here is gauge, what we call gauge 22. This is the geological survey gauge at Purdue Avenue in Heaven Park. So the boundaries here, by the way, here's Interstate 170. This is Lackland Road up in Overland. We go out almost to Lindbergh. This is Old Bonham Road from Stacy Reservoir, coming through Olivet, turning south at Roof Park, dipping into Northern Clayton, back up to University Hills along Delmar and over to Skinker. Gauge number one is here at the Wilson Buyout Track. Two is at Fogarty Park. Those are operating. This is the one we would like to get up and running in Olivet. The control center is a cloud-based SaaS system. If you're not familiar with that acronym, there's a tendency now toward on something like a flood warning system, as opposed to buying your own server, your own software, buying your own telecommunications equipment, hiring IT people to put all that together. You simply hire that service from a cloud-based provider. And so that's what we've done. The rain gauge manufacturer has a cloud site for that purpose. The gauges transmit data to our private account at that center. We can log into that. And one of the beauties of this, aside from the fact it's a lot cheaper than running your own system, one of the beauties of this is you don't have to be at a particular control center to log in. It's wherever you have a station. So anyone with the city that has the proper credentials can log into that control center. And from there, we can remotely configure the gauge, collect record data, and set up alarms. The software also provides for a public portal. I believe the commission members and 3 or 4 people on city staff have that. I will send it out to members of the council after this presentation. It's a little boring until you get a rainfall because you just see a bunch of zeros. We eventually intend to make that public when we have the system fully developed and have the public education campaign that goes with it. But it's the emerging trends towards software as a service and the fact that we're using cellular data transmission that makes a system like this as affordable compared to several years ago when we would have had to buy all sorts of special telecommunications equipment and so forth to do this. All right, so so system performance. When Dr. Chris did this back in 18 and 19, just looking at the data, there were pretty tight correlations between some of his protocols and the flooding that resulted. And that suggested that we were going to be able to have a fairly reliable predictor. Understand, of course, this is statistically based. It's a probability game. It's not to say we're always going to get it right, but it looked pretty promising. We've had three events since then. The minor flood back in May of 2019, the predicted peak stage, and I guess maybe I should make clear that what we did here is go back to the MSD rainfall records. Our gauges were not up at that time. And we downloaded that data for that event and then ran the prediction protocols on it to see what they predicted, and then compared that with what actually happened based on records from the gauge in Heman Park. So that was a smaller flood. We predicted a peak stage of 14.2. It hit 14.8. I should explain that flood stage is 14. That's not a problem. At that point, the water is just kind of at the top of the bank. You don't start running into problems until you get up about the mid-15s. And the biggies are 16-footers. We've had seven of them in the 20 years the gauge has been there. And by the way, six of them have been in the past 10 years, which should probably tell us something. So in that case, we didn't issue an alarm. It just fell a little bit short of the threshold, and that was perfectly appropriate for that flood. Then in July 22nd of 2019, we predicted a peak stage of 16.3. It was actually 16.2. Here's the important part, though. If you look at the timeline, we would have issued a warning at 5:50 in the morning. 13 minutes later, we hit flood stage. And an hour and 2 minutes later, we maxed out at the 16.2. So, you know, in between those two numbers, if you look at, I didn't put it on the chart, but if you look at the mid-15s, let's say, when things start getting tense, you've got about 40 to 45 minutes lead time there from issuing an alarm. And then the one we had last August was a very comparable flood. We over-predicted the peak stage there by a little under a foot. Again, if you look at the timing, the warning would have come in at 1:50. I don't know what it is about these storms that like to hit in the middle of the night when we're all asleep, but the warning would have come in at 1:50. And then 15 minutes later, we hit flood stage compared to 13 up here. And 1 hour exactly, we were at max compared to an hour and 2 minutes here. So, you know, it's a limited sample size. I guess, fortunately, who wants more of those? But it certainly looks like this is a pretty solid predictor. All right. Technically, we've solved most of the hard issues here. What do we need to do to get this thing going? We've got two things that need to be done. We need to get that Olivet gauge up and running. Now, I believe Sinan started talking with them back in November. Last I heard was they were scheduled to have a walkthrough of the site. I believe it was on March 19th, where they were going to discuss some renovations they were making. And they were going to eyeball possible gauge locations at that time. I haven't heard anything further. So, you know, maybe Sinan can chime in later if he's heard something further. But we can be up and going a week or so after we get that gauge in. That's an important gauge. That's in the headwaters where a lot of our water comes from. They're 100 feet higher than we are, and that stuff comes roaring down off the hill into U City. So we really need that gauge up to go fully operational. Then we need to decide how to disseminate warnings to the public. We don't envision the alarms issued by the systems going directly to the public. they should go to whoever the city designates, but I would assume that would be our emergency managers, so, perhaps 9/11 dispatch, and they would then issue the public warnings. We don't envision sirens being sounded for something like this. It needs to be more targeted. There are any number of vendors that provide targeted notification services, both routine things and emergency services. You know, a lot of business and colleges use those for active shooter alerts, for instance. The best known of those systems is Code Red. Jefferson County is using that for their flood warning system, as well as other emergency warnings. Olivet used it until a year or two ago. I don't know if they had a need for flood warning, but for other emergencies, and then switched vendors a year or two ago. I think maybe that's a local vendor, Siren GPS. But I guess the bottom line is the city emergency managers need to be involved in this. I think item one and two here, we've kind of reached the limit of what the commission can do, and the ball is kind of in the city's court on these things to go further, but we'll sure assist however you want us to. Last I heard on number two, by the way, I had a conversation with Sinan actually by email some time ago on this, and he said he had had a conversation with Chief Henson, who was aware of Code Red and had some information on it. And I think Sinan was going to ask around, and I asked him for guidance about what further our emergency managers would like us to do here. So I think the ball is in the city's court on these two things. Turning now from to the future, the city has not in the past collected proper data on flood events. There are cities around us that for any flood can tell you what the high level mark was at any property that was flooded, along with an appraisal of the damages. The most important thing, especially for a flood warning system, is to have records of those high water marks. Nobody has to take a risk by going out during a flood and doing that. You go out the day of afterward and look for those stain lines and debris lines that tell you what the high water point was. And at the very least, you photograph them. Ideally, you have the surveying equipment to measure their elevations. This is important to have. And then other damages, building inspection reports, first responder reports. I have seen a couple of first responder reports on those recent floods we had the last summer or two, but that's the only data I've ever seen on any past damages here. Oh, and I did see a photograph record, I believe compiled by the police department, of damages after the 2008 flood. So we would suggest you to measure the ideally measure the elevations of the high water marks, and that you procure the surveying equipment required to do that. Now, we've done something to make that easier for you, which I'll explain in just a second. And probably might be a good idea to post signs showing historical high water marks in the, you know, at some of the various problem areas around the city. Might not be appreciated by some real estate agents, but I really feel personally, and I think probably most of the rest of the commission does too, that that's information that people that are moving into that neighborhood need to know. And our disclosure laws are not what they should be. And that's actually one of the topics coming up in some of the commission's public education outreach we're going to cover. The other thing you could do, if the city is willing to spend some money, and we can put together a proposal for you, not a fortune, is if we could instrument that stream, we've got the horsepower on the commission to get a better handle for what the dynamics are of actual floods as they occur. Dr. Chris suspects that a couple of our bridges are undersized. And at the flood last August, just for example, the water was somewhere between 18 inches and 24 inches over the deck of that bridge. it's a pretty good indication something's not right. It would be good if we could find out specifically what's not right there. Finally, the commission has been engaged in a number of other activities. Now, some of them are, the first one here is pretty relative to the warning system. So in order to collect elevations, measure elevations for these high water marks, that's pretty expensive if you have to hire a surveyor to come out, and the surveyor is going to have to find the nearest benchmark and work his or her way down from there to the actual point that you're trying to measure. That's pricey. So about a month ago, we asked Sinan to rent for us a state-of-the-art satellite-based surveying system that uses global navigation satellites as its input, along with some ground stations that MoDOT has established in the St. Louis area. That system is remarkable. It will, if you can see enough satellites, it will measure elevations to the nearest inch. And we verified that by taking it around to several benchmarks. Then we went to the neighborhoods that are prone to flooding, Hafner Court, Groby Bridge, Wilson Avenue, all the usual suspects, and established reference or control points there, essentially to serve as working benchmarks, so that the next time we have a flood, we don't have to have that satellite system, although it's not all that pricey to rent, actually. But really just ordinary surveying equipment, you now have a reference point right there near your watermark in the neighborhood. So you can just shoot from there with an ordinary survey equipment, total station equipment, which is much, much less pricey than the satellite system. So we'll be glad to help you do that, members on the commission, but I think for consistency, that needs to be embedded as a procedure. That's the responsibility of the city, and we'll be glad to train people how to do that, and we'll be able to be glad to price the surveying equipment it'd take to do that. It's not a fortune. The commission has also developed materials for public outreach and education, some of it regarding the warning system, but also on a lot of other things. Pretty large white paper last fall, which we haven't published, but that's going to serve as the basis for spinning off several articles for ROARS and possibly a website if we decide to establish one. You may notice that we are soliciting photos and information from the public on past floods. We're trying to fill the gaps there because we don't have data from them. We had an ad in ROARS, the last ROARS, and I believe Mr. Karsh recently sent a targeted email out to our database of people that the task force found in their database of stormwater problems. We have a commission member that's developing a 3D printed model of our watershed. It's pretty remarkable for possible public display. And I believe Mr. Thompson and Mr. Karsh have been attending the Corps of Engineer team meetings. That's really all I have to present. I'll be glad to answer any questions you have, or Mr. Thompson, if I've left something out and you want to chime in, or Sinan, I'll turn it over to someone else.
Just a couple of add-ons. Mark Holley has arranged, I think he just sent out an email, and he's arranged, he wants to get together tomorrow afternoon or early evening at his garage. He wants to, he's going to have the 3D model there, the one that the prototype, and so that we can take a look at it if we want to. So I plan to attend.
No, that's a deal.
And Sinan, I don't, you know, or anybody else on the city, you know, I think that it's, you know, it's an open invitation type thing, as long as we maintain proper protocol. But I don't know who's buying beverages. So as far as, you know, I think one of the things that's kind of up in the air is this, you know, Olivet's commitment to getting this sensor installation defined and worked with us. I went out and took a look, did a walk through that park, and it's really a very undeveloped area. And I think the point I want to make is that it, you know, I think they're not really sure what they want to do with it. And so maybe it may not be their stonewalling. They just don't really know what they want to do with it yet. And, but it could be like a greenway. It could be jogging paths. I don't know, any number of things, but, you know, we're not talking about it's not a very intrusive installation that we're talking about. So whatever we can do to kind of get to help them make a decision. As far as Sanan and I have been, and Eric Karsh has been sitting in on these Army Corps of Engineer meetings, they're getting ready for a presentation. They're preparing for to make a decision, meet a milestone, and then, you know, make a recommendation on what to do. But it does entail primarily detention basins and levees or flood walls in some residential areas and also in some commercial areas. And so the flood walls and or levees, which would also include traps, you know, something to close off a road or an opening in the flood wall. Those are going to be expensive, and I think they're kind of leaning more to if they can achieve their goals with detention basins, and they're looking at two primary areas in U City, another one just outside of U City. So just a heads up, you know, they're going through their process. And they're using modeling, 3D surface modeling to evaluate them. And I think that's about it.
Okay. Are there questions for members of council, either for our speakers or for Sanan? And the only question I would have is, Mr. Clay.
First of all, I want to thank you, Mayor Crow. I want to thank the Stormwater Commission for their work. I just want to be clear on exactly what next steps are. That may have been said and I may have missed it, so I apologize, but if that can be restated.
Two things. We need to re-engage all of it, and what Mr. Thompson said is kind of my understanding too. They're looking at renovating that entire park. And I asked Sanan to pass along to them that we sure don't want to wait for them to do that. That's a couple of years down the line. We're not asking for much here. This is, in fact, anything we put up could be relocated pretty easily. So if we could get that back on track, we need to be talking to our emergency managers about how we want to handle notifications once we issue a warning.
So the Gage in Indian Meadows Park, and which clearly is not solely our decision, actually not our decision at all, but in terms of alerting the emergency managers, that's clearly within our purview. So
right, and we didn't think
we can make that
happen. Right, we didn't think that the commission should go too far down that path without asking our emergency managers to, you know, to participate in that.
Okay. Thank you.
You know, and I'm happy to step in at any point in time, but my guess is that Sanan's already made outreach, and then Gregory probably knows the city manager of Olivet pretty well. I know she's probably very interested in what happens in University City as well. But the mayor and a couple of the council members are known associates of mine, so I'd be happy to help if that's what anyone feels is appropriate. So Gregory, I'll sort of leave that with you and Sanan, unless I hear otherwise.
Yeah, I was just gonna say, I'm familiar with the city manager. I think that Sanan is trying to go through the department director, but at some point, yeah, we'll need to maybe bump that up to the city manager's level.
Yep, okay. Anything else? Alita?
Yeah, I just had a question. So does the Olivet piece have to be in place before we can move forward with any warning system?
No. You know, if the rainfall were uniform across our watershed, which is about 12 square miles, all you'd need is one gauge. The reason for having three gauges is to ensure that you're adequately accounting for the variations that occur. But, you know, not all rainfalls are that non-uniform. So the two gauges we have up is a heck of a lot better than nothing, which is what we've had in the past. And in many cases, would give you adequate warning. You know, just to cover all bets, you really need that third eye over there in Olivet. But yes, we could at this point issue, we've got technically, we have the alarms configured and everything. Right now, an alarm would come to me or to Dr. Chris. And so, yeah, we could go with what we've got.
Thank you.
Surely.
I would like to join Councilor McClain thanking you folks for the incredible work you have. It is quite a benefit to our community to have such talented people living in our community. So I hope that we can get the Olivet piece put together. And if we need to help with some funding, hopefully we can find that funding. But we do appreciate, we know that this has been a concern for our community for decades. But of course, particularly since the Wilson Avenue flood, is truly something we'd like to address. So thank you guys for moving this ball much further down the field. We appreciate it very much. So thank you.
Thank you.
And you are welcome to stay, but I think we'll move forward to our next part of the agenda.
Good evening. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Eric.
Thank you. Honorable Mayor and Council members, our next agenda item is minority participation policy. You had asked that that we bring back to you what the existing policy is. So I have Finance Director Keith Cole that will be presenting what our current policy is and taking any direction that that you have. Mr. Cole.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Rose, Honorable Mayor, and members of Council. I will share my screen to show. Let's see. Are you able to see that?
We are. It's in work form, not in presentation form. But yes, we're able to see it. There we go.
Okay. So this is the presentation on minority participation program. So our current policy is, and this is in our code under chapter 135 under the contracts. And it states that this is for the personal requirements for contractors that we do business with. And basically on this section of the code, it's like, if we go into contracting with a firm or corporation and the costs are more than $50,000 or more, that involves 10 or more employees within that workforce, then at least 20% of their workforce that's providing the service shall consist of workers generally classified as members of minorities and or female workers. And for the next, and that's the first one was for the 50,000 and the for the for 100,000 or more, that if we, when we do business with a construction company, that they have, that they deal with subcontractors with at least two or more of them, then at least 15% of that total amount of the contract shall be allocated to members of minorities and or female workers. And then our next part of the code, that this is when the company is, with respect to employees and owners of that, of the companies, and as many as, if the contracts at least $2,000 shall be entered into, entered with the following, that the individuals generally classified as members of minorities and or female, and the firms consisting of individuals generally classified as members of minorities and or female, and then the corporations, the stock of which is owned by individuals generally classified as members of minority and or females. And the city manager can take all reasonable steps to achieve this compliance with this part of the code. And then the next section of this code of the contracts, it's dealing with the it's continuation from the employees and owners, that the city manager, he can report to the city council of our efforts in carrying out this section to be in compliance, and all minority and or female firms, corporations or individuals shall file an affidavit with the city prior to commencing the work that they are indeed a minority and or female firm, corporation or individual. And basically, that's kind of what our current code that's that we are using, that that deals with minority businesses that entail with females and minorities. And if you have questions, I'll be happy to answer.
Honorable Mayor and council members, before you get to the questions, I did just want to state, this is one of those areas that was decentralized. I think this year we made the first steps towards centralizing it again up under a finance. As I understand it, we have a purchasing coordinator position. We're currently in the process of trying to put together standard operating procedures that the various departments can follow. But I would say at least for the past probably, you know, Layla Fitch, I think, was the last purchasing manager that we have. And I don't believe they, that the city has had anyone since her. So we've only started this process within the last year of trying to centralize this operation again and get to a point where we can do a very good job in reporting what the results of our purchasing program is. So I, myself or Keith, would entertain any questions that you have.
Mr. Clay. Thank you, Mayor Crow. So that, that was gonna be my, my first question to City Manager Rose related to reporting, because this is certainly a topic I'm interested in, and I would believe that my other colleagues are as well. I want to understand where we are before, personally, I would want to go down the road of recommending changes. And so now that you've brought it into finance, it's been under finance for at least some period of time. When do you think we can start to get some reporting on where we are with our minority contracting?
Yeah, I'll defer that to Keith. I know initially our priority was just getting procedures in place that were followed. There are some that we have to comply with that's based upon state statute, but every department was doing their own thing. So I'll ask Keith to respond to your question.
Councilmember Clay, yeah, so I have a draft of we have a purchasing policy, and I have a draft, our purchasing specialist, she revamped our policy, and I have a draft of it, and I need time to review it. And then once we get it reviewed, then that will go into, we'll implement that throughout the departments. And then this section will be part of the purchasing policy. And then we will then make sure that we'll be in compliance. You know, that will be part of that policy.
Okay. Do we have a sense now of, and I'm getting the feeling perhaps that we don't, of minority contracting, those with contracts in excess of 50,000 or 100,000, whether or not they are meeting the percentages?
Honorable Mayor, Councilmember Clay, I don't believe that that has been tracked. That's not to say that they have not been meeting it, but they certainly have not had to prove that they have been meeting it in the past, and they probably haven't done so for at least 10 years. But that said, I don't think that's an excuse not to, going forward, ensuring that they are complying with your policy as well as state statute. So that's the intention. But we have to have the resources in place that allows us to execute those policies. And I think we have a portion of those resources in place now with a purchasing specialist, but we're going to need greater resources than that if you want to really do a good job with the oversight of purchasing. So the reason I think Mr. Cole is hesitant to put a date out there for you is because we've got so many challenges that we're dealing with the TIP, getting that set up. But I would suspect within the next probably 90 to 120 days, we should have those policies in place. And then I will come back to you and indicate what are the resources that we need in order to execute those policies.
Okay.
I think, Brian, I think you're next.
Thank you, Mayor Crow. This may be a question more for our city attorney opposed to Mr. Cole. And my question has to do with the code itself in section, well, A and B, in that if you know, we're requiring anything, any contract, 50,000 or more, we're requiring 20%. Can you explain to me why, if we're asking, if we have a contract of 100,000 or more, that we're asking for less participation, which is 15%. And the other part of that question is that something council can change at some given point in time? Because if we're asking for more, why aren't we asking for more participation? If we contract more, why aren't we asking for more? And if you could explain that, please. Either one.
I think on section B, it could be at 15% because they're dealing with the subcontractors within that corporation that their companies can subcontract their work out. And then I'm thinking that's why then it's reduced to 15%. But I mean, I don't know for sure.
Yeah, I would tend to think that's it too, that when we're directly contracting with someone, we've got a 20% limit or a goal, if you will. And then if whoever we've hired then subcontracts it out, they've got a lesser goal of 15. And Gregory, you or John could correct me, but I mean, we can always amend these policies. We've just got to understand that we've got to be, if we amend it, we've got to hold ourselves accountable to enforcing it. And so I think it's always open to discussion. Frankly, it'd probably be a good opportunity for us to see what the communities around us have done, because we probably haven't looked at these policies. And I don't know, Wade, the entire time I've been on council, I don't know that we've looked at these except way, way, way back. So it probably would be a good opportunity for us to even just see
if we're leading the pack or if we're at the back of the pack on minority participation, because I would think that our community would want us to be leading the pack and not be in the back. And we may have just let this one move too far off the radar screen. And I realize it may not be as applicable for the Olive and 170, I presume, but particularly if we're gonna be doing a large construction project ourselves, I would tend to think that we would want to know the rules that we're gonna play under and the rules that we're gonna be held accountable to. And we ought to have an idea of those rules as we move forward. I think those are great questions to ask.
Yes, sir. And Mayor Crow, I appreciate that. That is exactly, I would love to hear where we stand in reference to our surrounding community in making sure that we are in line and or leading the pack. So yeah. I would love to get that information. Please, thank you.
I'm not sure the most efficient way for us to do that, Gregory, but
I was just going to say, I think that we're happy to do the research to identify, you know, how our policies compare to the surrounding, our surrounding neighbors. But the key issue is going to always go back to making sure that the resources are there that's needed to execute the policy. And unfortunately, this is just one of those areas that in the past had been gutted.
Okay. Yeah, I don't remember ever seeing a report since I've been on council. Maybe I did in the very beginning, but so I think we recognize we have room for improvement here, to say the least. And we appreciate this being brought to our attention. Gregory, I am assuming that unless someone else has a question, we really don't have enough time to do a closed session now or any part of it.
Mayor, I agree. I think it will take longer time than what's allowed. Okay.
So unless someone has anything else to say, then we will adjourn the study session and we will start in about 9 minutes on the public portion. And then it's my understanding that we will have an executive session. So we'll look forward to a motion then to go into executive session. In order to make the public meeting move more, not necessarily more quickly, but since we've already discussed the change to the agenda, I'll just call for someone to amend the agenda on item number H3 to be continued. That way we'll just move forward through that part of the process, if that's okay with everybody. So, Tim, do you have a question?
No, sir, I just said moved.
Okay, all right. Thank you very much. See you guys in a little while.
Take care.